Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nartigal. Donna is out of the kitchen this week, but she will be back with us next week. We talk about lots of things on this show. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And we're glad you're with us today. Well, agriculture feeds us. We talk about that a lot on our show. But it also impacts the earth. There's a lot of us. There's a lot of farmers, there's a lot of land under cultivation. So how can we make farming better? We seem to realize that not everything we do is good for the earth. But joining me here at the kitchen table is Ruth McCabe. She is a certified professional agronomist, an Iowa certified crop advisor, and a conservation agronomist with Heartland Cooperative. She works directly with farmers to implement in-field and edge-of-field practices to benefit soil health, water quality, and wildlife. Welcome to the show, Ruth.
Thank you so much for having me, Lana. I'm excited to have a conversation with you today.
Oh, good. Well, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into the area that you are working with. You work with Heartland Co-op now. So what do you do and how did you get there?
Oh, yeah, we don't have 4 hours. So, you know, I'm from California. I'm actually from Long Beach, Southern California. And yeah, so I'm a transplant to the Midwest, and but I love it here. But what's interesting is I wasn't raised on a farm, didn't know anything about farming, actually, until I was getting my undergraduate degree. And it's a fun story to tell. I had been in the military, and when I got out of the military, I came to the Midwest and decided, okay, I'm going to go to college. And I was getting my undergraduate at the University of Minnesota, and I was just going to do biology, and I had to take an evening lab class. And the only class that worked for my schedule was a class called Agronomy 101. And I remember thinking, this is going to be the most boring semester ever. And actually, I loved it. 2 weeks later, I went to my advisor and I said, I'm switching to this agronomy thing. And my advisor said, do you even know, you know, like, do you know what agronomy is? And I said, I don't, but I'm going to find out. And I haven't looked back. So got my bachelor's in agronomy, worked at the University of Minnesota as like a junior scientist there, and then came down to Iowa State University to get my master's. I was offered a fellowship to study crop physiology, and so I took that fellowship and came down to Iowa and worked as a researcher at Iowa State for a little bit. I've bounced around the Midwest now in my professional career as a technical agronomist, as a seed agronomist, as a cover crop agronomist. And, but, you know, in my personal life, I also became interested in hunting. When I moved to the Midwest, there's a big hunting culture here. And so I really got interested in hunting. And I'll tell you what, you learn real fast as a hunter, especially in Iowa, which has access to very little public land, that without habitat, without preserved areas, you're not going to have animals to hunt. And so I got very interested in conservation just in my personal life as a hunter because I realized just how important it really was, especially in the Midwest, especially in Iowa. Then along came a position that opened at a large agricultural cooperative in Iowa, a large ag retailer, a company I never would have thought that I would go work for because I wasn't interested in selling inputs or chemicals or anything like that. So as somebody unaware of what an ag retailer really does, I thought I never want to work for them. But they had a position that they advertised for an agronomist who had familiarity with conservation. And by golly, that really interested me. So I decided to apply for it and interview for it. And interestingly, in my interview, and my boss will tell you that this is exactly what happened, I said, what the heck are you guys doing hiring a conservation agronomist? What are you thinking, you know?
I was going to ask you the same thing. It's a wonderful thing. What did they say?
Well, they had a great answer. It's what made me ultimately decide to accept the job. They said, we don't know what we're doing, because traditionally the conservation space has really been dominated by nonprofits or public agencies, and agritailers haven't wanted a voice in this space, and we haven't been asked to have a voice in the space, not really. So we don't know what we're doing, and that's what we're hiring you for, kid. And they also said, you know, we have a lot of customers and farmers who want to learn how to use conservation practices, and our sales agronomists can't. They weren't trained in this. They don't know how to help them, and we don't know how to help them, but we do have more and more customers asking for our help. And the thing is if we can't help them, they're going to go somewhere else and take their business somewhere else. Whereas if we help them, sure, they might apply less chemical, they might use less inputs, they might conserve, right? But at least we're keeping 75% of their business, where a competitor has none of their business and would happily take that 75% of their business. So the logic was great, and they offered me the position, and I took it, and I've been building the conservation program at Heartland. I'm the conservation manager, been building it now for 4 years. And we have a lot of really cool partnerships on the ground. We do a lot of work getting conservation out there. Lots of cover crop work, lots of buffer work, waterway work. We do CRP. We're now getting into wetlands. It's very exciting. It's very weird. We come into a room and people are like, what? Why is an ag retailer in this room? But it's getting to be more and more common. There are other ag retailers that are building conservation teams. I like to think that it is a movement that is like a freight train. And it's not slowing down.
Oh, that's great. You did answer my question. It seems like an ag retailer, yes. Why do they want to conserve things? And you have implemented the things that you tackle are basically saying, slow down, let's look at what we're doing. You talk about in-field practices and edge-of-field practices. Can you just mention a few things that actually happen out there?
Oh, yeah. Great question. Yep. So conservation farming practices, there's a whole suite of them in the conservation space. We frequently refer to them as CFPs because it's easier to say that. But there's in-field practices, things that are done in the field. They're usually year by year, things like cover crops or switching to strip-till or no-till. It's stuff that's slowing down erosion or reducing the loss of nutrients in the farm field. And the idea is we try to keep as much in the field as we can before it gets to the edge of the field, meaning it has left the field, but it hasn't made its way into the waterway yet. And so edge of field practices are things like buffer strips or filter strips or saturated buffers or bioreactors or wetlands or small nutrient ponds, riparian areas. These tend to be areas of perennial and more permanent vegetation or structures because it's sort of the last ditch effort, pun intended maybe, to keep those things in the field rather than letting them get into the waterways. So in-field practices are exceptionally important. I want to see more of them. We don't use enough in Iowa, but it is rising. You know, in this year, we've reached about 3.5 to 4 million acres of cover crops. 10 years ago, we were at 10,000 acres of cover crops. So we're doing fantastic, and it still needs to increase. We need more no-till. We're only at about 30% adoption of no-till in Iowa across all of our acres. But we have a lot of grass waterways. We got a lot of terraces. We have a lot of buffer strips and filter strips compared to states around us. We just need to keep stacking. We need to get more infield, more edge of field.
Oh, that's great. And all this depends on getting people to try new things. Do you think farmers they're kind of on the bandwagon now? They realize that things need to change? Or do you have to? Is this a hard sell, Ruth?
Sometimes, and actually, oh man, so we have to unpack who actually is making choice about how their land is being managed, because that is, I'm actually writing a manuscript right now all about that, focusing on, we say farmers, like it's just this blanket statement for the people who are managing the land, when in reality, it is so much more complicated than that. We're not looking at landowners enough, that's for sure, and landowners have a significant sway over what's done on their property, because 60% of Iowa's land is rented, and I think a lot of people don't realize that. So 60% of Iowa ag land is rented. It is tenanted. It is not owned by the people who are farming it, and of those leases, 80%-ish, are cash rent year-by-year leases, between 70% and 80%, depending on the year. So if you're a tenant farmer and you don't own the land and you have no idea if you're going to farm it again next year, the incentives are very low for you to pay to adopt a conservation practice. And yes, we have cost share programs. They do not cover enough of the adoption for most in-field practices. And landowners, when I'm out trying to sell conservation practices to tenants, they will often ask me, let's get together with my landowner. I want my landowner to hear this. I want the person who owns this property to hear this conversation. I've lost count of the number of times that it's not the farmer, it's not the tenant that isn't on board. It's the landowner who says, well, sure, I don't care. My farmer can do this, but he's going to have to pay for it. She's going to have to pay for it because I'm not paying for them to adopt that practice, even though they do have an incentive for that practice to be adopted because it protects their soil and it improves their farm. Or I've heard landowners say, well, I don't want to put in waterways. I don't want to put in grass waterways. I don't want to put in buffers because I'm going to lose 2.8 acres of rent from that farm. 2.8 acres. That's like $1,000. You're losing your soil every year. You can't sacrifice $1,000 to put in some grass waterways so that you're not hemorrhaging soil every year because you've got gullies that form. Anyway, I could go on about that, but the question is it a hard sell? Yes, it is. Sometimes it's the tenant or the farmer that it's hard to sell it to, and sometimes it's the landowner that it's hard to sell it to.
Ha, ha. So we're in the process of teaching people to do new things. Speaking of learning new things, you had some travel opportunities recently. Talk about the scholarship program you were part of, and you went on quite a world adventure looking at farming practices all different places. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yes, I did. And if any of your callers are interested in participating in this scholarship program, you should connect them with me because we're always looking for more scholars. The program is called the Nuffield International Farming Scholarship Program. Nuffield is N-U-F-F-I-E-L-D. It actually originated in England from Lord Nuffield, who, when he passed away, set up several different trusts. If you go to England, you will see Nuffield hospitals and Nuffield medical centers. He was known for his work in the medical industry, but he also established the Nuffield Farming Scholarship Trust. And it spread from England to several other countries. So what it is it's a 1 to 2 year program. You're selected to represent. It's competitive. You apply. You're selected to represent your state or your country or both as a scholar for a particular year. You pick a topic of interest that you want to study. You put together an application explaining how you're going to study that topic. And then you pick countries you're going to travel to where you're going to learn about that topic. And if you're selected, you travel for between 3 to 5 months over the course of 1 to 2 years. It just depends on what your day-to-day life looks like and how many responsibilities you have at home. You are given a scholarship to do the travel. It's tight. It's not easy. You are not staying in nice places. and you're crashing on the sofas of many farmers around the world. But anyway, you travel as a group to a few countries together, and then you travel by yourself to between 3 and 5 countries that you choose. You set up the travel. You do the logistics. You find the contacts in those countries. You do all of it. And so I did that. I traveled with a group of my cohort for that year to several countries. And then we went to Southeast Asia. I'm just going to do blocks of places that we went rather than listing all the countries. But we went to Southeast Asia. We went to Europe. We were in South America, and then we went to Australia. That was a part of my group travel. And then by myself, the specific places I went were I went to the Chesapeake Bay for obvious reasons. They have nutrient and water quality issues. And I went to Canada to look at no-till adoption in the prairie provinces of Western Canada. I went to Brazil to look at no-till and cover crop adoption in Brazil, which is our biggest competitor for grain production. And then I went to Australia because I wanted to look at sustainable grazing systems in eastern Iowa. And I'm sure you're seeing a theme. My research topic was looking at how conservation farming practices are adopted in other countries. I wanted to see what's driving adoption in other countries. Is there something we can learn that I could bring back to Iowa?
Well, that's great. And was Heartland Cooperative supportive of this? It sounds like some of this information would be handy for them to know, too.
Absolutely, yeah. So before I even applied for the program, I actually, my company is very, very forward-thinking. They're very progressive, where if an employee has an idea for something that is skill-building or capacity-building, or that they have a business idea for the company, we have to write business proposals that we present to our leadership. And then those business proposals go through the various levels of leadership and they consider it and they say, you know, yes or no, right? So I actually wrote a proposal for why I thought, hey, you hired me to lead this conservation team and to build this conservation team out. I've heard about this program. It would give me a fantastic opportunity to learn about conservation as it's being applied in other places, to learn about business structures in other places that use more conservation than we do. Maybe I could help our company build out our team if you let me do this program. And I thought for sure that they would just laugh me out of the room. They did not. They seriously considered it. They brought me in and they said, well, okay, we think this is a good idea. We want you to do it. We're going to treat it like as if you were going to graduate school. So like tuition reimbursement, we're going to let you take that time to go and travel. But then, you know, you're going to stay with us for so many years to basically pay back that time as like a graduate student would do. Right. So you go to school and your company pays for higher education. They expect you to sign some sort of a contract to prorate it out over time. Right. Makes perfect sense. And I thought that was a fair deal. And so I said, let's do it. I think that's a great idea. I love what I do. I happen to love my company. So staying there for a few more years after this experience is exactly what I would have hoped for. It gives me a chance to apply what I learned. So yes, to answer your question, they were supportive. They were supportive and all they could tell me was, the next few years are going to be very busy for you.
And so you came back from this adventure. Well, we'll talk more about your adventure, but you came back from this adventure just last fall, right?
Yeah, just this past fall was the last of my travels. I actually traveled over 2022 and 2024. I went on 4 different trips. I went on 3 one-month trips and 1 two-month trip over the last 2 years. So I went to, you know, Canada for a month, Brazil for a month, the Chesapeake in Canada for a month, Brazil for a month, Australia for a month, all by myself. And then I went with the group travel for about 2 months.
Oh, for goodness sakes. So you should, hi, my name is Ruth. I'm here to learn everything you want to tell me.
Pretty much.
What a wonderful opportunity. That's great. I want to take this opportunity to do a quick station break. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking to Ruth McCabe about some wonderful opportunities that she's had to travel. Ruth McCabe is a professional agronomist currently working for the Heartland Cooperative, and she had the opportunity to travel around the world. And what sort of wonderful things did you learn, Ruth?
Oh, boy. again, we don't have 3 hours, but I learned a lot, unsurprisingly. The little things I learned, American percolated coffee is better than anybody thinks it is. Any country you go to where they say you're going to love our coffee is the best, unless you like drinking motor oil or battery acid, no. Our country, our America's percolated coffee is not that bad. So that's number one. Some other things that I learned is that the food in Brazil is the best food I've ever eaten. So I just want to go back and eat only Brazilian food. It was amazing, delicious, phenomenal. The people there were warm and welcoming, and just I loved Brazil. It was my favorite. Australia, starkly beautiful, reminded me of like the desert. It was so gorgeous there. Western Canada, the whole.
Yeah. What part of Australia were you in? It's a big country. What?
The entire eastern half.
Okay. Go ahead.
Eastern Australia, I really should go there, but I was in the entire eastern half. So from northern Queensland all the way down to Melbourne, Victoria area. So, and then everything in between. I road tripped in all of these places. I road tripped in every country. I can't tell you, I had a few flat tires, couple breakdowns, lost in the middle of nowhere in Brazil, a country I don't speak the language. Just amazing experiences. Canadians, by the way, are really nice. The whole Canadian nice thing, it's 100% real. They are genuinely really nice, like creepy nice, like Hallmark movie nice, which I was not prepared for this. Anyway, so those are the small things I learned. The agriculturally related things that I learned were conservation farming in other countries is not adopted because other places are more enlightened than we are. People use a lot of no-till and cover crops in other countries because financially it absolutely in the short term makes sense to adopt those practices. And it's not because they're doing it because they give a fig about the environment. I mean, they'll tell you they do, and that's great, but they're doing it because the next thing you'll hear from them is, oh, yeah, and by switching to no-till, I could get a yield every year. So now I'm harvesting every year instead of having to do a chemical fallow. I heard that with every farmer I interviewed in Canada, pretty much Western Canada. In Brazil, yeah, I use no-till and I use cover crops because it protects my soil during the dry season and I can keep moisture. And now I can get 2 harvests per year instead of one. I don't have to dry season fallow. So financially, it made perfect sense in those two countries to adopt conservation. Same story in Australia. Same exact story. Dry, arid. It just so happened I went to places that had crappier soil than we do in Iowa. And so adopting things like no-till and cover crops in those places makes perfect financial sense in the short term. The Chesapeake, different story. They get a lot of rain there. Sandy soils, but they get a lot of rain. Makes sense to use no-till because of hashtag sandy soils, but cover crops, not really. However, they have very aggressive cost-share programs in the Chesapeake. I talked to a lot of farmers who said, yeah, I take a hit to my corn yield every year by using rye cover crop, but I get $80 an acre to use that rye cover crop, so I'm going to do it on every acre anyway. So one of the big lessons I learned is that I think conservation farming practices, people will tell you a million reasons that they're adopting them. They will say, oh, I care about the environment, or, oh, I want to pass this off to my children, and that's great. That's probably all true. But in every conversation I had, and I interviewed over 100 farmers in several different countries, about 50 different researchers or agronomists in several different countries, and God knows how many government professionals in different countries. And the thing I kept hearing come up over and over and over again is, yeah, but it has to make short-term financial sense. Long-term financial sense, if you're a landowner, you'll do it. But if you don't own the land, the long-term financial anything just doesn't pan out because you don't know that that land is going to be yours in another 5 to 10 years. It has to make short-term financial sense. That was the big, big take home. I call it a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Did you come up with that? No, okay.
Yeah, right. I made that. Yeah, uh-huh. You can go ahead and just ascribe that idiom to me. Okay. I would love to take credit for that.
Oh, goodness. You mentioned that Brazil was your favorite place beside the food. And I've heard that before, that Brazil and Iowa, people kind of, we look at each other as producers of food. Can you talk more about that? About is their climate the same? What are they producing that makes it of interest to us people here in Iowa?
Oh, well, they're on the world stage in terms of grain production. They are our largest competitor for corn and soybean. They're actually number one in the world for soybean production. So Iowa maybe number one for soybean production, or number two if we want to compare ourselves to Illinois. We may be important for those grains here in the United States, but on the world stage, Brazil blows us out of the water for soybean production. They are number three in the world for corn. We are number one in the world for corn. But they are rising rapidly with corn production, and they'll probably surpass us, my guess, in that particular field at some point in the future as well. So they're our largest competitor, and they produce commodity crops. And they don't just produce corn and soybean. They produce a lot of other stuff, too, oranges, coffee, sugar. They're number one for oranges, coffee, and sugar in the world. They're a huge agricultural powerhouse. Their climate is nothing like ours. They have a dry season that's very arid, and then they have heat, a lot of heat, and then they have a rainy season. So they can produce and grow all year round. We cannot. We're temperate. We have a cold winter. They do not have that, for the most part. But they also have very old, weathered forest soils. The entire country once upon a time was covered in some version of a forest, not the Amazon rainforest, but some version. As you go further south, it would get more into like savanna or chaparral type forests. And further north in Brazil is where you're going to encounter the Amazon or the rainforest. But all of those soils are very old, very weathered, and not particularly fertile like ours are. Forest soils are thin. And as soon as you remove the trees, you've just removed that soil source of nutrients. So, one thing I noticed in Brazil that is very different from Iowa, it's easy to get sucked into a kind of echo chamber here in Iowa and think that we're just awful and we're destroying our land. And as much as I loved Brazil and it was amazing, the people were great, I want to emphasize our erosion is nothing compared to theirs. The average rate of erosion in Brazil is, well, it's all over the place actually, but it's anywhere from, 10 to 100 tons of topsoil per acre per year.
Oh my goodness. Repeat that. Oh, that's horrible. 10 to 100.
Yep. Oh, and 10 to 100. Yeah. Depending on where you are and what they're producing. And where I was mostly in Midwestern Brazil. The average erosion rate around where I was in like the 30 tons of topsoil per acre per year ballpark. Yes. Your jaw is dropping. Your audience cannot see it, but I went there for about 6 weeks total because I also went as a part of a group. I took so many pictures and examples of widespread erosion. I mean, it would curl your hair. It was just wild. And their soils are so vulnerable to erosion. They're much hillier than we are.
Oh.
And they may use a lot of no-till. I think that's the emphasis here is they are almost, depending on where you are, they're between 60 and 100% adoption of no-till. And they're at countrywide about 60% adoption of cover crops. I want to emphasize those practices do not save them from erosion. And I would hear from farmers, yeah, we don't have erosion anymore. I would hear this from them, and we hear this, I think, in Iowa too. Oh yeah, we don't have erosion anymore because we use no-till. And it's like I would point at the edge of their field where they blatantly have a gully forming, and I would say, well, what about that? And I'd hear that. No. Those form every rainy season. We just come out and fill that in.
They fill it in? What? Okay. All right.
Yeah. So, but it's like, well, where did the stuff go that was in it before? And if you, any of their rivers, you drive across any of their rivers and they are red with sediment. So, I think it was kind of heartbreaking for me. I fell in love with Brazil. It's hard not to fall in love with Brazil. The people there, they don't have a subsidized farming system the way we do. So they are really hard scrabble, and the really big farms there are by hook or by crook. And you have to admire that. You have to admire it. Another thing, 86% of their roads are not paved. And when I say dirt roads, y'all, I don't mean gravel. I mean dirt roads. That take 8 hours. It took me 8 hours to go about 80 kilometers. 90 kilometers to get to a farm in the north part of the country because it was all dirt roads and it was rainy season. So it was just wild how I even made it there. I don't know, but they are hard scrabble and they are making it work. You cannot help but admire them, but there is a part of me that wants to go down there and say, okay, look, you guys, you're losing your precious resource that is making you such an agricultural powerhouse. You guys have to put in more terraces. You need more waterways. You need more shelter belts. Like, you need hashtag all the things.
Oh, and you mentioned shelter belts and put in. We hear about deforestation. So that's one of the reasons is that's not stopping the erosion anymore.
Yeah, there is. Brazilians are very sensitive about the topic of deforestation, mm-hmm. as you can respect when you go down there. You can have two realities at the same time. So if you go to Brazil, you can acknowledge that there is a significant amount of deforestation that has happened there and is continuing to happen, even though they have the Brazilian Forest Code, which is one of the strictest, if not the strictest, forest codes in the world, where they do require that you maintain native vegetation on every farm, depending on the biome, to a certain percentage. And in the Amazon, it's 80% of your property has to remain in native vegetation if you farm. So, you know, I want to be clear, they do have legislation in place to try to protect some of their resources, but they are still, there is still deforestation happening. Most of it is illegal, not legal deforestation. It is illegal, but they are very sensitive about that topic, and they have a point, and their point is this: every other major farming place in the world got to deforest and mine their natural resources when there wasn't an internet and there wasn't a media. And so they weren't under a spotlight, and now they're looking at us, and we have in the last 30 years gone from being a net importer of food to a net exporter of food. Our economic situation is rising rapidly. We don't want to lose that opportunity. And everybody is looking at us and telling us that we have to take the sacrifice for the rest of the world because everybody already destroyed their stuff. And that is a fair point for a Brazilian to make. And so I learned very quickly not to bring up deforestation when I was in Brazil, because I got that lecture many times. And I honestly, I guess I think I deserved it. They're not wrong. They have a right to bring that point up. And it's pretty hard. I think it's pretty hypocritical for other countries to point at Brazil. I would agree with them. Hypocritical for other countries to point at Brazil and say, gosh, look at all the bad stuff you're doing. When it's like, yeah, but you have the economic position that you have because 300 years ago, y'all deforested your farm fields and started farming. But I think it's valid. Doesn't mean it's not happening. Doesn't mean that deforestation isn't happening. And it doesn't mean that it's not tragic. I visited a farm in northern Mato Grosso, which is right on the edge of the Amazon. I will not lie when I say that my heart broke, you know, as I was like driving by soybean fields and then boom, there's the Amazon right there. And it's, you know, and then you could see all the illegal deforestation happening too. And it's so big and so vast, and their federal government is a little disorganized. They have a very hard time enforcing forest code rules. There's a lot of deforestation happening that the government doesn't even know about and couldn't enforce if they wanted to.
Oh, you sent me some pictures of your travels, and there were some pictures of Brazil. Number one, yes, I have seen you took pictures of gullies, of washed out gullies next to cornfields in Brazil. And well, living here in Iowa, I'm used to the soil being dark, and this was like red clay. Yes. Is it clay? Anyway, it looked like it could just like blow away to nothing. Also, you mentioned about the infrastructure with the roads that are available. How do they get their product to market there, Ruth?
Yeah, they don't have trains, so they don't have any kind of train system. It's all by truck, Super Bees. I took a video because I was riding with somebody in a truck on one of these dirt roads for about 200 something kilometers through the northern part of Mato Grosso. That took about 12, 16 hours. And that's only 120 miles, just for context. It's all by truck. Again, if they had better infrastructure and a more organized federal government, they'd be blowing us out of the water for grain production. And it's not even a joke, but they don't. Their soils, by the way, they are red like that because they are high in clay. They're also like very old weathered soils, oxisols, ultisols, forest soils. So very weathered forest soils, and they have that red color because they are higher in clay. It just pretty much turns to slime when it gets wet.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
Oh, goodness. What kind of farmers did you visit? You said you got to sleep on farmers' couches and things. Are these?
Yeah.
what's the size of a farm? Who is doing the farming in Brazil?
Yeah. So I visited smallholder farms in southern Brazil all the way to massive multi-tiered business farms in like Mato Grosso or Mato Grosso do Sul. So like the biggest farm I visited in Brazil was about 100,000 acres. Yeah, cut into multiple different farms, but they have about 100,000 acres that they farm. I went to a 30,000 acre farm business that it 30,000 acre farm, but they also have a trucking business and a cattle business, a livestock business and a shipping business and something else. And then I visited like some smaller 5,000 to 10,000 acre farms, which are considered pretty small for like Midwestern Brazil. That's just Brazil. Like in Canada, the farms are really big too. So when I was in Western Canada, I visited a couple 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 acre farms up in Canada, which is pretty normal. The smallest farm I visited in Canada was a 4,000 acre farm, which is small. So, yeah, Australia, same thing, massive farms. There's a, you know, again, soils are much poorer in these places. And I didn't think about that before I designed my travel, but I was going to places with really poor soils compared to us. And so you need a lot more land, right, for the level of production that you're looking for. So you just get to see these much larger, you know, properties than what we have, you know, here in Iowa. The farms here are obviously a lot smaller, a lot more productive, and a lot more expensive.
Is the soil leaving the land equally quickly in Canada and Australia, where you visited too? Sounds like Brazil are losing it quickly, and of course we know we are too. Is erosion happening there too, and other places?
It is, yes, yep. So they, yep. I, one of the big take homes again, another lesson I learned is that erosion is everywhere. Iowa's definitely not the worst. Our rate of erosion is between 5 and 6 tons of topsoil per acre per year. I ain't saying that's great because it's not, but we're certainly not at 30 tons of topsoil per acre per year. Canada and Australia are lower than that in general in places. They're usually in the 2 to 3, you know, maybe sometimes 4 tons of topsoil per acre per year, depending on where you are. You get into the steeper places or the horticultural places or the organic places, and you're going to see higher rates of erosion because horticultural or organic operations in those countries are far more reliant on soil disturbance than because they can't go to no-till. And they will, you know, because that's another thing. I always have people asking, well, everybody should just go to no-till. And I'm like, but if you don't like chemicals, you're not going to like no-till because no-till technology is very reliant on chemicals. If you get away from chemicals, you're getting into like an organic operation, then you don't have chemicals to help you control weeds. So now you're using mechanical tillage. You're using tillage in the field. So in Canada, Australia, especially when I visited like horticultural places, there were higher rates of erosion just because they have to use more mechanical tillage, like vegetables required it in many places, and large scale vegetable. And then organic operations required some tillage as well. So it just depended. But Australia and Canada certainly have less erosion than we do. Canada has a problem, however, with salinization, as it is Australia. They both have issues with salinization, so it's their soils becoming saline sodic. And that was something new to me. I've never seen that before.
Oh, my goodness. Explain what that is.
Yeah. So, like, as an agronomist, it was actually really exciting for me because I'd only ever seen saline sodic soils in soils textbooks. I'd never seen it in real life, and I first experienced it in Western Canada. The issue is that they have shallow water tables, and they have calcareous subsoils that are filled with dissolved salts, basically, and they don't get a lot of rain, and they have sandy soil, so a lot of upward movement, very easy for water to move upward in the soil profile. So imagine that you have dissolved salts in your subsoil. You only have 5 inches of topsoil. You get a very heavy rain. Some of those dissolved salts move upward in the profile a little bit, and then it's hot and dry in those places and windy, so that water evaporates very quickly and pulls those salts to the surface. So there's rising rates of saline spots in Western Canada, and you'll see them as you're driving around because you'll see a lush field of crops, and then there's this giant random dead circle in the middle of the field that is white, and it's because there's all these salts in that spot. It's usually a lower spot in the field because that's where the water would pool and form kind of what looks like a bathtub ring of salt. And there's more and more tenants in Canada. There's more and more tenant farming in Canada, and it's expensive, or I should say you don't make as much money planting crops that would solve your saline problem, i.e. planting longer-lived perennial forages. So if you plant a forage, like a perennial salt-tolerant forage, it'll pull that water table down a little bit and break that connection of the water table to the soil surface, so you don't get these salts pooling at the surface. And then these forages will, you know, slowly collect salt out of the soil as they grow, and you can kind of mitigate the issues. But there's a lot of tenant farmers that don't want to grow forages anymore because they're moving more and more into growing lentils, grains, beans, et cetera, small grains, et cetera. And that's where they make their money, and they're a tenant farmer. So why would they grow forages, especially if they don't have livestock to feed those forages to? And landowners just want the rent. Sound familiar? So you're seeing more and more of these saline spots popping up around the countryside in Western Canada, because where's the incentive to prevent that saline spot from growing? I'm just going to keep growing cash crops as long as I can. And again, I spoke with a lot of farmers in Western Canada who mentioned, you know, nobody wants to talk about that's happening, but it is happening. And there's more to it than that. If the further west you go, you get into saline issues that are related to irrigation, because they grow more potatoes, and that's a whole other thing. So, I mean, you know, so, and then it's a similar story in Western Canada. You have irrigation-related salinization that's happening. I'm sorry, in Western Australia as well. You have irrigation-related salinization happening there. And again, when you're producing multiple seasons of these cash commodity crops that are not conducive to removing salts from the soil, or that production requires adding salts to the soil, then you start seeing these rising rates of salinization, and the solution is not profitable in the short term to stop it from happening.
You are listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. As we have mentioned before, to support this fine radio station, go to khoifm.org/membership. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Oh, goodness. This is something to chew on. As a consumer, I'm thinking, okay, all you farmers out there, you can just kind of tweak things, but it doesn't sound like it's so easy. You mentioned forage crops. So I know, like you say, tenant farmers need a cash crop right away, but did you see any farmers that, or visited farms that were grazing, sheep or cattle, are they better on the soil?
I did. I visited lots of grazing operations in Brazil and Australia especially, and then, you know, a handful in Canada, in Western Canada anyway. And I guess it just depends, you know, livestock, if incorporated into a system that also rotates their land and their farms through cash crops and forages, and then rotates with livestock and does grazing. You know, those are obviously, from a soil health and an erosion prevention standpoint, fantastic operations. In Brazil, I actually saw, it's an up-and-coming practice. It has several acronyms because it depends on what you're doing, but basically they're promoting this system of integrated livestock forestry and cropping systems. They call it ICLF or IPLF for... it's got a few different acronyms. It was really cool to see where they grow eucalyptus in combination with pastures in between the rows of eucalyptus, and then they do cash crops, and they rotate these fields through this massive rotation every 5 to 10 years. If you're a landowner, it makes perfect sense to do this system, because now once you get it up and running, it takes about 5 years to get it there, but once you get it up and running, now you've got log harvest, you have livestock harvest, you have cash crops that you're getting all from the same system, and you've only got cash cropping happening every, you know, 5 to 7 years or something. So your erosion rates are much lower, and it's just a fantastic system. I saw something similar, less involved, but something similar in Australia on a few farms and in Canada. And those systems are great. And if you're a landowner, it makes perfect sense. If you're a tenant, you don't have the upfront capital to install something like that, to do something like that. It's very expensive. And why would your landowner want you to do it? They just want to, you know, they want a rent check every year. So they're not going to probably let you do a system like that if for the first 5 years you tell them, all right, I'm not going to be able to give you anything for the first 5 years. You know, that doesn't make sense. So I do want to say, you mentioned being a consumer. So I do want to, that's something else that I've realized as I traveled. Consumers also have a role to play in our agricultural land use situation. And I want to touch on it because it's important to me. So here in Iowa, I go to presentations, I go to conferences, I speak with more environmentalist audiences frequently, and I will often hear the sentiment of, you know, farmers need to do more. I would argue so do landowners. But also I would say, you know, I don't disagree with you. I can get on board with this logic of wanting tenants, farmers, and landowners to start working harder to preserve our soil in the state. I can get behind that logic. However, the number one type of fuel purchased in Iowa by far, by millions if not billions of gallons, is ethanol blended fuel. And the number one place that people purchase their groceries in Iowa is Walmart, followed rapidly by Aldi, Dollar Store, Dollar General, et cetera. We like cheap food and we like cheap fuel in this country and especially in Iowa. And so I would argue that it's one thing to say, and then for that matter, you might like organic produce, but you don't want to pay for it. And there's lots of statistics that show that people don't want to pay a lot of money for food or fuel, right? So my point here is we might espouse these beliefs that we want the land to be treated better, but then we go out and with our wallets, we spend money in the places that don't support that same belief. I'm all about our industrialized agricultural system in Iowa. Actually, I'm an agronomist and I work for an ag retailer, and I think it's okay that we have an industrialized agricultural system here. I'm not afraid to say that. And I think that that can still get along with conservation practices. I think it can all work together, but everybody's going to have to pay for it, even the consumer.
Ah, lots of good things. You learned a lot of things on your travel, and you are in the process of turning this all into a paper. In other words, what Ruth learned on her grand adventure.
Yes, I'm writing a manuscript. It is consuming my weekends and my evenings right now. I just want the darn thing to be done, actually.
That's good.
I feel like I'm in grad school again. Yeah, I remember it's bringing back memories of graduate school and writing my thesis, and now I'm remembering why I promised myself I would never do that again, and it's okay. It's coming together nicely. It's going to be a wonderful manuscript. I have to give a series of presentations this spring and summer and into next fall, for that matter, so I'll be presenting in several different venues for some of my sponsors, because I was sponsored by Iowa Farm Bureau, by People's Company, by my own company, by Pork, Iowa Pork, Iowa Soybean Association, and then I'll be giving presentations to like the Iowa Department of Ag and Iowa State as well. So a lot of folks will probably have a chance to hear my entire presentation, and I'm happy to share what I learned. My manuscript is open and free for anybody to read. It has to go through a peer review process, but then once it's published, it's open access. So,
oh, that's good. In conclusion here, I heard about your adventures. I met you last fall, and we talked about this a little bit, and all the wonderful places you visited and the travel adventures that you had. And you mentioned at the time, you said no matter where you went, no one wanted to talk about the elephant in the room, and I think let's just reiterate what the elephant is.
Yes, yeah, there is a big elephant in the room, and that is that every human being we're all pretty short-sighted. Doesn't matter what you do, how you live. We think about short-term profits generally over long-term sustainability. And the elephant in the room, and pretty much every farmer or researcher or government person that I spoke with, was just that conservation farming practices require a long-term viewpoint. Sustainability on the landscape requires that we look at the landscape with a long-term viewpoint, past our own lives, past the lives of our children. And when we're talking about short-term profitability or making money in the short term, those two visions do not jive. So the elephant in the room is conservation farming can absolutely happen. But as I said a few minutes ago, we're going to have to make it pay in the short term.
Thanks for all your information, Ruth. Ruth, can you give us your contact information in case people want to follow up and find out more about the things you have to offer?
Sure, absolutely. So we actually have a website. My conservation team has a website, and it's very easy to find. It is www.conservationagronomy.com. So that's conservationagronomy.com. Pretty easy. And we actually have a hotline or a phone number you can call, and that gets you to all the conservation agronomists. And I think my email address is on that website as well. But I'm at Heartland Cooperative. So if you call a Heartland Co-op location and say, hey, I'm trying to get a hold of that Ruth McCabe lady, they can give you my email or give you my phone number.
Fantastic. Thank you for being with me today, Ruth. This was great. Some people like to talk about their travels and share their travel photographs. You have some amazing travel information and information about the kind of things you do to help farmers farm better. Thank you for what you do, and thank you for being here today, Ruth.
No, thanks so much, Lana. Thank you for having me.
That there's a really good, if you're at a loss for cornbread, the Donalana Kitchen recipe page has the recipe for Paul Nelson's really good cornbread, and that's a good start.
That makes a nice stuffing too. Now, if you're going to make your own cornbread, you need to start it early enough so that you can let it dry out.
Yes.
Because just like your breadcrumbs, I mean your bread. I don't buy the stuffing mixes. I usually start from scratch and, you know, toast the breadcrumbs in the oven, bread cubes, sorry. And the same thing with the cornbread. You want it to either sit out on the shelf and dry out a little bit, because otherwise you'll end up with
soup,
mush in the middle of the bread. Although, one time, this is a starlet thing, Taya Leone mentioned for her Thanksgiving, she stuffs her turkeys with tamales.
What?
Well, obviously you take the corn wrappers off, but that ends up being masa and, you know, Mexican flavored meats and things. And that sounds really good to me also. Another option.
Who would have thought? Well, goodness. I suppose you could stuff. Well, actually. And
that's a Southern California trick where you can get tamales really easily. Yeah.
Some people just put some apples and oranges inside of the bird and cook it that way, which helps it stay moist and all that sort of thing. But do go for the stuffing. I would say that's the best part.
Yeah, but you need the starch-heavy sweet potatoes, stuffing, you know. That's part of the thing.
And then
the
be prepared for an afternoon nap. Yes, yeah. We do. Good. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We come to you on this fine radio station every Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. Or you can find us at our podcast.
Yes, wherever you listen to podcasts, just type in Donalana. That's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen. And we will just pop right up with our podcast.
Lovely. And we're here at the studios of KHOI in beautiful downtown Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. We are glad to be here. And I want to take a little opportunity now to remind you that community radio really is what it says. It's community radio. We exist because
of with you. With unity, right?
Unity.
With
community.
Community.
Right. So your support helps to keep this station on the air and keep this program on the air.
Yeah, and to remind you all that we are all volunteers. So it's not like we want the sponsorship for anything but total altruistic means.
Well, that too. We have fun.
We have fun. Okay.
We have
a lot of fun, and it keeps our brains working quite well.
Yes, it does. Donalana Kitchen is just part of a whole bunch of good programming here, local programming, but also we get national shows in too. But tune in, because you might hear somebody on the radio that you know, and there are such a variety of different topics going on all the time. And we'll go out with a piece called The Peacock Rag. My name is Lana Nostigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
Excellent Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.